Travis County Public Utility Agency, cause number 18668-CV. For those of you new to Third Court, which I don't believe you gentlemen are, you know you're allowed 20 minutes to argue. We have a lighting system in place, and when the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes left in your given argument. When the red light comes on, your time has expired, and you need to look to the court. Understand you've gotten with the clerk and have your time allotment as far as your rebuttal reserved. But we have housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off this morning, now would be a good time to turn it off so we don't disturb the litigants once they get going. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Mr. Anderson? Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
May it please the court. In front of you, you should have a hard copy of a map that we e-filed previously. The purpose of the map is to address the first two issues that are before you. The first one is whether or not the Hatchett plaintiffs have standing in the case. And the second one is whether the Hatchetts have vested rights with a protected project that's shown on the map under Chapter 245.
If it makes you feel better, I've been handed four copies of this morning.
Okay. So. Well, it's better to have more than less.
Yes, I've learned
over time. So just briefly, from a color coding standpoint, the entire acreage was about 912 acres. It was owned by the Hatchetts originally. The lot layout that shown approximately was shown to the PUA in about 2012. It was subject to an SCR that was approved for approximately 1,800 units. There was an MDP, which is the first step in the planning process, to Travis County, that was approved in 2013. At that point in time, there were no PUA policies or tariffs that regulated density or impervious cover. So from the standpoint, I don't think there's a dispute on this. The original SCR in this plan were the first permit in the series of permits under Chapter 245, Section 245.002, that entitles the project to have vested rights protection.
And as you go along and talk about these various permits, could you clarify for us? I understand there's sort of two phases or pieces. There's the one piece that clearly there's contract to be sold, and there's the other piece, I guess, that the Hatchetts themselves are holding back. Can you clarify for us what was part of the application and part of the permitting to begin
with?
Yes,
sir. So those are kind of tied together.
Yes,
so
sir.
That's kind of where I was going next with regards to the color coding. So Masonwood Development is the developer, has the property under contract. It's a conventional real estate contract. If the developer obtains the approvals he needs to develop, he'll take down the property in phases. And so that's what happened with the area that's shown in brown. That's the first phase. And an SCR was approved by the PUA for 700 units that are shown. That was approved in 2015. And Travis County approved the first phase development as a plat in 2017.
So I'm sorry, which color is that?
That's brown.
Okay, thank you.
And so Masonwood took down that property, purchased it. It owns fee title. It's being developed today. The remainder, as you can see, is still on record title by the Hatchett. So there's Mr. and Mrs. Hatchett. Mr. Hatchett is here, as well as JPH Capital, which is an affiliated corporate entity. They still have record title. They pay taxes on it. The contract with Masonwood that affects the remainder of the property was never recorded. So and I hope, Justice Rose, that addresses your issue on the timing and the permits.
No,
basically.
Thank you.
So the area that's shown in blue and pink was subject to an SCR in 2016, was filed on behalf of Hatchett. And then Travis County Municipal Utility District number 22, which is a MUD that covers this property. So they were the co-applicants for that SCR for the remaining 1,137 LUEs, which would basically complete what the original submittal was. That was denied by the PUA, and that's the reason that we're here today. So the first issue basically.
So the way that works, the MUD actually applies along with the developer and obtains water through the PUA?
I'm sorry?
So the MUD is actually a co-applicant?
That's correct.
Okay.
So the MUD would be It's kind of the financing mechanism, but the requirement and basically the first try at submitting that application was rejected by the PUA because it did not have the property owner's signature on it. So Mr. Hatchett signed it, returned it to the PUA. So there's actually a requirement that the owner sign the application, which indicates that clearly they had standing on that application and have standing today because their rights are impacted by the applicability of these impervious cover restrictions that have been that will be applied to the remainder of their property. With respect to the standing issue, I think, you know, basically there's record title. To me, there's really not much of a dispute that the Hatchetts have standing. They own the property that is subject to the restriction and had an SER application denied. The argument is that Masonwood, because they're a prospective purchaser of the property as equitable title, are the only ones who have standing. There's zero case law that supports that. The equitable title case law is basically if you have two private parties that are fighting about who owns this tract of land, particularly when there's a damages issue and how is that money to be allocated, or the two private property owners are fighting each other to see who really has title. We don't have that here. Masonwood agrees that Hatchett has record title. Hatchett agrees Masonwood has title to the area that they've developed. I think this issue is pretty well governed by this court's opinion in Pine Forest versus County of Bastrop, which is a 2018 case. And there the court held that conventional real estates do not, real estate contracts do not convey equitable title, which makes sense. So from that standpoint, I think the case law is clear. There's no case law that I'm aware of that in a declaratory judgment standing context that the record title owner does not have standing, even if there's a prospective contract on the property. So I think it's clear that the Hatchett plaintiffs have standing in this case. The second issue is the applicability of Chapter 245. Immunity is explicitly waived under 245.004 for declaratory judgment actions, injunction actions, and mandamus actions. There's no question that this is a project under 245. There's no question that there were permits that were submitted prior to the PUA implementing by policy and by tariff this impervious cover requirement. Applying the impervious cover requirement prevents the development of the project that's shown on the exhibit and that was subject to the first permit that was approved. The defense by the PUA is there's an exemption. 245.004 has about, I think, 12 exemptions. And frankly, most of my practice on 245 cases involves interpretations and definitions of what those exemptions are, because it's usually pretty easy to define what the permit is and the project is. And the PUA's argument is that the utility connection exemption applies here. We disagree with that. There's no case law that they cite in support for their interpretation of what a utility connection is. I think both from the standpoint of a common sense interpretation as well as the policy of 245 and the reason that it's there, that defense does not fly here. Well, the problem is that exception would swallow the whole, which is there's a permit, which is one of the permits in this case under 245.001, which is an agreement for construction related to or provision of service from a water or wastewater utility. Well, that's what every SER that the PUA enters into involves the extension of water lines to their system in order to allow the development to happen. So the PUA's argument is every policy that we change, every tariff that we enacted, basically falls within this utility connection rubric, and therefore it's possible that you'll never be able to effectuate the project that is shown as part of your original permit. They're basically saying impervious cover density equals a utility connection. And that flies into the face of the intent of Chapter 245. As this court said in the City of Austin versus Harper Park 2 case, the obvious intent of Chapter 245 is to prohibit land use regulators from changing the rules governing development projects in the middle of the game, thereby insulating already underway development and related investment from the vicissitudes and uncertainties of regulatory decision making. In addition, the legislature explicitly found that they wanted to combat new regulations that would increase the cost of housing and other forms of land development. So
that must have been a Pemberton opinion with the word vicissitudes used.
Yeah, that is not often utilized, but the Court of Appeals, you know, I think utilized it correctly there. So from a policy argument, it really doesn't make sense to say that this exception would defeat every single permit that would be pursuant to this service contract language in the statute that will always include line extension every single time. And to say that an impervious cover regulation equals a utility connection exemption, you know, simply doesn't make sense. In addition to that, we've listed in our briefs numerous appellate opinions that define or interpret or utilize the term utility connection to apply basically what makes sense. When you're trying to connect the water meter to a new house or building, that's what a utility connection is. And the legislature, I think, was saying, if you increase the cost for your water meter fee, or if you change the water meter requirements from this type of meter to something else, that's something that can be regulated by water utility because it makes sense. You want to have all of the meters and those connections to be uniform, even if they come later in the process. In addition, the reported opinions on it, the exemptions, there aren't very many of them, but we cite to four of them. I think each one of those, the courts were very careful to say that those exemptions are very narrow. And in each one of those cases, the Court of Appeals, where it was actually applied, said that the exemption would not defeat the project. In other words, they ruled for the developer, and they ruled against against the city with regards to whether or not the exemption applies or not. So from the standpoint of the case law, in terms of how the exemption is applied, the case law, we also have state statutes that are cited, plus the Texas Administrative Code, as to what a utility connection is, and they all refer to utility connection basically being that connection to the new building, new house, that sort of thing, not line extensions that are part of a water service contract, which is a permit, because again, that would be the exception would swallow the whole. So from that standpoint, we would request that the court rule that Chapter 245 does apply, immunities are waived under the statute explicitly, and that this project has vested rights that mean that PUA cannot apply a subsequently enacted impervious cover density limitation to the project.
Can you address the UDJA?
I'm sorry?
Can you address the UDJA claim? Why do you believe that court has?
That's right where I was going. So the third issue is exactly as Justice indicated. It involves the UDJA issue. And I think I'd like to point out first, from a policy standpoint, this is really not a stormwater quality runoff issue. That is already regulated, and the developer agreed to it with their first phase. The TCEQ has very strenuous regulations governing stormwater runoff, as does Travis County. And the developers agreed to those and has actually gone beyond that. So,
and do those have any aspect of impervious cover, or are they?
They do not. Okay. And so the standpoint, I guess the point is, impervious cover can be a tool for to regulate stormwater runoff, but there are lots of other tools that could do that. And I think the evidence is pretty clear here. The impervious cover is really, I don't want to use the word sham, that's a little strong, but it is really not the purpose of what they're doing. If you look at the record, it's really to limit density. That after this project was announced, there were folks primarily in Bee Cave. So Bee Cave selects two out of the five board members to the PUA, came out in opposition to the density of the project, traffic, you know, the typical things that come up, for example, in the zoning case, but there's no zoning here. We're in the unincorporated area without even having an ETJ of Travis County. I'm just trying to give the big picture there. There's not trying to shirk any responsibility for stormwater runoff here. The UDGA, this is not, we're not asking for an interpretation of the statute. We're asking whether or not the PUA has authority. And there's kind of, I think, in the case law, a little bit of confusion. And I think the best case recently by the Supreme Court is the Bizio's case. I tried that case and argued it before the Supreme Court. In that case, the issue was, does a general law town have authority in their ETJ to regulate building permits? And they argued under the state planning statute that that gave them the authority. And the Supreme Court says no, and as a result, that ordinance was null and void, which fits you within the UDGA, because it has to be null and void rather than an interpretation. So from the standpoint, we're not asking the court to interpret generally, does that statute apply to us? We're asking the court to declare that their tariff and their policies that impose impervious cover be declared null and void because they don't have the authority to make those regulations.
And is that tied to some constitutional basis?
That it's because it fits within that, because as an agency, they're like a general law town, like Lakewood Village was in Bizio's. Their powers are only what are specifically enumerated in the statute. That's distinction from home rule cities like Austin, you know, that have more police powers. They can do whatever is not prohibited by the statute or the Constitution. Okay. So that's the basic distinction between the two. And so from a merit standpoint, we're asking the court to follow I guess basically what the Attorney General ruled, that yes, there can be some conservation measures, because the word conservation is in the statute, but it has to be related to the geographical area for the district, and also fit, there has to be a nexus. So in this case, the water supply, the PUA is created to be a water supply utility. Their water supply is out of Lake Austin. The sole intake that's from there, none of the stormwater runoff from our property goes into Lake Austin. So there's no nexus there. And that's, we believe that that's a disputed fact issue.
That seems like a good stopping point while we hear from Mr. Parker. And
yes, sir.
See you again on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Parker.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. This case was brought by plaintiffs who never asked the PUA for anything. They're not co-applicants. The application is at page 145, or 154 rather, of the clerk's record. And it was brought solely by MUD 22. The case was brought to compel the PUA to enter into a contract with somebody else entirely, MUD 22, for something, utility connections, that the PUA is not legally obligated to contract for, and utility connections which are specifically exempted under Chapter 245 of the Local Government Code. Now, I said a lot there at the top we probably need to unpack. And as we unpack that suitcase, obviously standing has to come first. And these plaintiffs don't have standing in this case. These plaintiffs didn't ask the PUA for anything. MUD 22 asked for a contract with the PUA to extend service through a utility connection to this tract. If the PUA had agreed to MUD 22's request, these plaintiffs wouldn't have gotten anything. They wouldn't have been parties to that contract. That contract would have been a bilateral contract between the PUA and MUD 22, just as the same as the 2013 contract is when Masonwood Development made an SER and we entered into a bilateral contract between the PUA and Masonwood Development.
So they're directly benefiting from water being provided and the ability to go ahead and go forward with the development of the property isn't any sort of an interest worthy of?
No, Your Honor. This is, I believe, the Bocese Inlet case. And they're not a intended third-party beneficiary. They're not a co-applicant. There are innumerable members of the public who may today or may in the future benefit from various applications that are made on behalf of developers or others to the PUA or any governmental entity. But they don't have standing.
Is there a case that you can give us that where this concept of equitable title goes so far as to say that there's not standing in a situation like this?
Sure, Your Honor. I think, in a case specifically like this, no. The concept of equitable title, though, is important. And it goes back a century. And it
I understand generally the concept. I was just curious whether there's one where it goes to a standing.
It doesn't challenge. Go to standing in a case like this where we have a developer. What we do have here is not a conventional or a run-of-the-mill real estate contract, as the appellants claim. What we have is a unique, very complex contract, as reflected in the map that is before the court. That map's not in the record, but it is important to show the unconventional nature of this contract. A conventional real estate contract is one where we all know what it is. We've all participated in one. We agree, I'm going to buy your house for a certain amount of money. And when we enter into that contract, we agree that we're going to go down to the title company in 30 days and we're going to exchange the legal title for the money. And this isn't that. This is a contract that was entered into a decade ago, whereby, and the contract's not in the record either, but they describe it in their pleading. And what they describe is that it has a takedown schedule, whereby on certain events that occur in that schedule, legal title is transferred from Hatchett to Masonwood. But during that time, and you see in that demonstrative where we stand at this moment in time, but during that time, Masonwood bears a lot of risk, has a lot of risk. They paid money out of their pocket, and they have a contract for this entire tract, but they only have equitable, but they only have legal title to a portion. And the doctrine of equitable title says that you have equitable title to the entire portion in case some risk come to fruition. If the government takes the property, if there's a fire that destroys the property, if the local public utility agency won't grant water service to that property, then it is the buyer that has equitable title that gets to vindicate those rights. It gets to sue the government for the taking. It gets to sue if it's a thing like out in the Bastrop fires. It gets to sue the adjoining landowner for the damage to that entire property.
Now, is there a case that clarifies that buyer's right to sue in a situation like that is exclusive to the sellers in that?
Yes,
contract?
Your Honor, that's the Austin Livestock case out of this court from, I believe, 2013 that's in our briefing. And it is the exclusive right of the equitable title holder to the exclusion of the legal title holder.
Can I ask you a question? Going back to your argument that the application was solely in Mudd's name.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is your position that if the Hatchetts were part of that application, then that they would have standing?
No, Your Honor, because fundamentally they're not the equitable title holder. But the fact that they weren't part of this request, that they weren't part of the 2013 Masonwood request, completely reflects that it is Masonwood that has the equitable title.
Okay, so your argument is not because they're not on the application, they don't have standing. Your argument, that's just evidence of them not having equitable title.
It is completely indicative. That's exactly right, Your Honor. It is completely indicative of the fact that they don't have a dog in this hunt. It is Masonwood. When Masonwood applied for that 1,837 living unit equivalent, basically household units, when Masonwood applied in 2013 for that 1,837 households, That was for the entire tract, not just the bit on which they had legal title, because they had a much smaller bit of legal title back in 2013. They were applying for all of the units on the entire tract.
And didn't that include pieces that the Hatchet owned in fee simple?
Yes, they had legal title to, but because it was after this contract, Masonwood has the equitable title to the entire tract, which is completely consistent with the fact that they were the applicant for the service for, to the entire tract. And had they had their request been denied, they are the ones that would have standing to be here to file suit if there was a suit to be had.
So what would have happened if the request had been denied, Masonwood walks, the Hatchets still own the property, they reapply? Would they have standing then?
If the Hatchets reapply?
Mm-hmm.
If Masonwood walks the contract, conceivably, Your Honor. But they wouldn't have good claims on the claims that they have brought, because the claims that they have brought are non-jurisdictional. There are two claims, the Declaratory Judgment Act claim and the Vested Rights Chapter 245 claim.
But from a standing perspective, say there had been some ultra-virus act at the PUA.
Sure.
And Masonwood walks, the Hatchets think that they're damaged by the ultra-virus act. Wouldn't they have standing to at least bring that claim? Even though, as you say, they didn't have an equitable title?
Well, I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know that you would have an interesting question about what their present injury is, what the case or controversy is, because there would be no, then I think, live application before the PUA. So I don't know the answer to that question. But to your question, though, about would they have an ultra-virus claim, well, the answer is no.
Well, no, that wasn't the question. That was a hypothetical.
Sure. In that hypothetical.
As I understand it, no one's brought an ultra-virus claim.
Nobody has brought an ultra-virus claim. That's exactly right. And this is a classic ultra-virus claim. The Bezos case that appellants reference is against a city. And the UDGA waives governmental immunity to find invalid municipal ordinances. We're not a municipality. And they're not trying to invalidate any municipal ordinance here. This is a classic ultra-virus case. It's mispleaded. And even if it were correctly pleaded against the correct defendants, what they have alleged fundamentally is the ultra-virus act of refusing to enter into a contract. It's actually not an act, it's inaction. And it's squarely within the discretion granted to this public utility agency.
Can I ask you a question? What is, if you're wanting to get judicial review from an action that your PUA has done, what is the process? What do you envision as being the correct process for getting judicial review?
The correct judicial process, Your Honor?
Before we, well, including exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Your Honor,
if you have a problem,
sure.
What am I supposed to do?
File an ultra-virus act, action. If you have a problem with an action that we have taken, then the proper remedy is to file an ultra-virus action against the directors or the governmental officials that took that action in their official capacity. That's what Heinrich says. That's what SEPSIC says.
There's no administrative remedy. You don't have to go through the, you know, the actual PUA. You don't have to go, obviously, through the PUC.
No,
you just go straight to court.
You can go straight to court with a properly pleaded ultra-virus claim. But the problem here is that the act, and every ultra-virus claim has to have an ultra-virus act, right? An act that's outside legal authority. And the act here that appellants complain of is the act of refusing to enter into a contract. And it's really inaction. And inaction can only be an ultra-virus act if it's mandatory, if it's something that's ministerial. And in order to have a mandatory or ministerial act, you need a statute that says shall. And the statute here doesn't say shall. It says may. This is section 572.060 of the local government code. It's our enabling statute. And what it says is that the PUA may enter into contracts with private entities for the service of water, for water service, on terms that the PUA's board of directors deems appropriate. We're actually given two levels of may there, two levels of discretion. We may enter into a contract, or we may not, on terms that the board of directors, within its discretion, deems advisable. The appellants would have this court completely rewrite that statute to take out may and substitute in shall, and say the PUA shall enter into a contract when somebody asks for one, and completely X out the line on terms that the board of directors deems appropriate.
And is this one of those situations, I've seen cases where people are trying to be removed from the service area, is there another provider or another way that they could receive water service if not through this PUA?
You know, Your Honor, it's not in the record, but Your Honor is exactly correct that we are outside, that this tract is outside our CCN. And so we don't have a monopoly. There are, any other provider could provide service to this tract legally because they are outside our CCN. We don't have a monopoly. Practically speaking, they have options. They could conceivably dig a groundwater well. I don't know if there's available groundwater. I'm not a hydrologist on that, but conceivably they could. Alternatively, there are other water service providers in the area for which they could contract. I will tell Your Honor that the cost would be higher, but that's not to say that there aren't other providers available. There are other providers available. The board, in refusing to agree to the contract with MUD 22 that MUD 22 asked for, exercised its discretion, the discretion granted to it by the legislature, and in so doing, acted completely within the PUA's legal authority. There's also the contention that appellants made that only Article 16, Section 59, Conservation and Reclamation Districts can do impervious cover restrictions. And of course, impervious cover restrictions aren't really the crux of the matter. The Ultra Virus Act is not agreeing to the contract. And we didn't even not agree to the contract because of impervious cover restrictions. But aside from that, in the Quick versus the City of Austin
case. So why did you, if it wasn't impervious cover restrictions?
Sure, Your Honor. And this is at page 339 of the record where you have the board minutes for that meeting. And the discussion from the board is the fact that we don't have the capacity to serve this tract. This tract is down Hamilton Pool Road, and we have a transmission line that goes down Hamilton Pool Road. The Hamilton Pool Road line is what it's called. And it is catchy. And so if I drop and say the HPR line, the HPR line is full. All the capacity in that line is spoken for. And it would take $9 million in new infrastructure to connect this tract to the capacity, to bring new capacity down to this tract and connect it to the system. And the district did not want to spend that money, didn't want to, you can't just expand a line, it would take a new parallel line.
So how do all those reasons play into what we have before us, which is a standing and jurisdictional question? I mean, that sounds pretty fact intensive.
Sure, Your Honor. Well, they don't have standing because they're not the equitable title holder, and they didn't ask for anything. And the act, ultra-virus, the merits of the issue, whether this is within our legal authority or not, is a legal question. And the act that's alleged is the act of refusing to enter into a contract with MUD 22 for the purpose of building this connection, to connect them onto our system. And that is something, it's not a matter of fact.
And when you talk about MUD 22, are you talking about just the second phase, the 2016 application?
And that's all we're talking about in this lawsuit, Your Honor. Okay. That's the only thing that was pleaded in this lawsuit was MUD 22's application, the 2016 application for 1,137 households. And that act of refusing to contract with MUD 22, that's the Ultra-Virus Act that is alleged. And it's squarely within our virus as a matter of law. And so because the ultra-virus claim, mispleaded though it was, but ultra-virus claim is without merit, the district court was correct that it didn't have jurisdiction to dismiss the case. There's also the other claim, the Chapter 245 vested rights claim. And 245 does have a waiver of immunity if it applies. But Chapter 245.004 has a bunch of exemptions, including utility connections. And that's fundamentally what we're talking about here, is utility connections. How do we know that they're asking for a utility connection? It's not that hard. On that tract, there's no water service today. If there were a tap out there and you went to turn on the tap, nothing would come out. Maybe air would come out, that's it. MUD 22 wanted water service. The only way to get water service was to connect to the PUA's system physically with $9 million worth of infrastructure to connect and have those pipes that currently don't connect go clink. And that clink sound that you hear has a word in English. It's a connection. And that's exactly what we're talking about. And the exemption makes sense. Appellant talked some moments ago about the policy of 245. And this makes sense within the policy of 245. 245 is about restricting the government from impairing development on your property. It's not about forcing the government to spend money to build infrastructure off your property. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. That clink, that connection, is a utility connection to extend from the water, the existing water system, onto the property. There are plenty of places in which we have existing utility connections. And if there's a development that has a utility connection, any kind of construction that has an existing connection, then we would not be within this exemption. We would be within 245 more broadly.
Isn't the cost issue generally addressed through the contract as far as, you know, additional cost and rate setting and that sort of thing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
This issue of cost, I mean, if it's a $9 million cost issue, isn't that something that's generally addressed through the contracting process and rate setting?
It can be, Your Honor. And that is certainly something that goes to the scope of our legal authority. That goes to the, on the terms the board deems appropriate. We can agree to contract. We can decide not to contract. If we do want to enter into a contract, we get to negotiate the terms that we want. All of that is the scope of our legal authority. And so can we roll that into our rate, that cost into our rates? Sure. But then we have the rest of our ratepayers subsidizing the cost of bringing new water to this one tract, which is a decision the board decided that it didn't want to take. Your Honor, when my friend gets up for rebuttal here in a minute, I think there are three questions that the court ought to perhaps hear from, ought to hear answered. First, how do you get water service from a water system to which you're not currently connected without a utility connection, without that clink? And the answer is you can't. Secondly, what statute requires the PUA to enter into a contract with MUD 22? And the answer is there's not one. There's no shall. And third, when did the appellants ever deny these appellants a utility connection? And the answer is they didn't, because these appellants don't have this property anymore. For that reason, the district court was right. It didn't have jurisdiction, and its judgment dismissing the claim should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Let me try to first address this issue of who submitted what. The last application, I think what opposing counsel was referring to in the record was the first, I guess, submittal that did not have the property owner's name on it, was sent back, and Mr. Hatchett was required to sign it. In the reporter's record, there was one exhibit introduced, Plaintiff's Exhibit 1. It's a chronology, and it says August 1, 2016, SER submitted by Hatchet and Travis County Mud for 1137 LUEs to serve the remaining Hatchet property. So either way, either it's a disputed fact issue, which defeats jurisdiction, or there's clearly example here. I think everybody agrees that it affects the development of the rest of the property that's owned by the Hatchets. And it, you know, I guess the follow-up, if there's a need, because it's a plea, and it's supposed to go on the pleadings, to go back and allow repleading to basically clarify that, we can easily do that. But the facts in reality are is that Hatchet was one of the co-applicants. Real quick on the equity issue, Austin Livestock is not on point. It is not a case that involves standing from a debtory judgment, Chapter 245, or anything else. That was a fight about money. Remember, I said there's two fact situations where equitable title comes up. One is there's a fight about proceeds. In that case, I think it was a condemnation case, and who gets the proceeds. Or it's somebody says, I own that property. The other one says, no, I do. And there's a fight about that. He is correct with this issue that in the statute, the UDJAA, and this goes back, I think, to Justice Trauna's initial question about the UDJAA, it does specifically state in there that it applies to trying to declare either a statute or ordinance null and void. And we don't have that here. What we have is we have a legislative body that has enacted things that are like ordinances. It's a tariff, it's a policy, but it's not specifically enumerated in there. And we cited in our brief several cases where the courts have said that's not an exclusive list, the statute or ordinance, that if you have a legislative body, that a plaintiff that's aggrieved should have the opportunity to the judicial process to be able to ask a court to declare whether it's null and void, not an interpretation issue, which I clearly understand. That would be ultra vires, would be separate and apart. But I think the initial step on the analysis in the court, I think, would have to find, and we're urging the court to find, that the reference to statute ordinance is not exclusive, that if you have so many legislative entities have been created, governmental bodies that have implement policy and rules and regulations with nomenclatures that are different than ordinance, we would ask for the court to declare that they apply.
Can I ask you the same question? What is your opinion in order to get judicial review? Do you, obviously you don't agree that it's only through ultra-virus, but if you were to want judicial review on a PUA decision, what's the appropriate administrative way to get that prior to going to?
I'm trying to make sure I get this right, but I think the exhaustion of administrative remedies is what you're looking for. I don't think there's another administrative process beyond requesting a permit and having it denied, which we did with the SER. Okay. I don't think there's another policy or procedure. I haven't seen one in their tariff or anywhere else to do that. I think the only recourse is to file a lawsuit, which we have. And I think that Mr. Parker would agree with that, but I don't want to speak for him on that. A major red flag that I saw was when Mr. Parker said, we can arbitrarily deny water service here. And within the context of the first phase and the amount of infrastructure that was put in was a massive amount of infrastructure. The PUA's policy is new development has to pay for new infrastructure. So all this, you know, argument about we don't want the ratepayers to pay, that's a red herring. The policy of the PUA is that $9 million, we have to pay the $9 million, and we're willing to do that. But we have a first phase that was developed as a water storage tank sized to develop to serve the rest of the property, et cetera. I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. It's a complicated and well-argued case. The court will take it under advisement. That being our last case of the morning, the court will stand in recess. You're all excused. Thank you.